Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. I hope you've had a chance to get some breakfast, coffee, etc. I'm very, very pleased to have this meeting today because we're talking about an issue that is always on everybody's lips, but we don't often get down into what it really is all about and how it works, and most of all, what can be done about it. I'm very, very pleased about our speakers today who have extraordinary experience. A couple of housekeeping things. Today's meeting is on the record, so you may take all this information and even say where you got it. Second, though, still I'd ask you to turn off your cell phones, beepers, etc. It interferes with the sound system and kind of gets in everybody's way. I just saw, looking at a report that we'll hear more about, there's an estimate from the Global Financial Integrity Program that says that the amount of money that has left Africa illicitly over 39 years is put as high as $1.8 trillion. That's a pretty shocking figure. Without question, has to be addressed if all the things that everybody wants about Africa are going to take place. We have three wonderful participants this morning, and they're going to go in this order: Raymond Baker, and then Rafael Marquesh, and then Malum Nuhu Rabadu. Raymond Baker is the director of the Global Financial Integrity, think tank, and the author of an extraordinary book, Capitalism's Achilles Heel, Dirty Money and How to Renew the Free Market System. He's done extraordinary amount of research around the world, interviewing companies, people, et cetera, doing a good deal of digging, and is now, I think, the leading spokesman on the nature of the complicated and largely corporate sources of illicit movement of money. He lived in Nigeria for 15 years, and so knows that country well. But his material is available on the, if you haven't seen it, Illicit Financial Flows from Africa, Hidden Resources for Development. This has just come out, I think, this report. Ray, it's a delight to have you here, and I'd ask you to begin.
Thank you, Princeton. Are we on? Thank you. And I'm delighted to share this opportunity to speak with Nuhu and with Rafael. This is the reality with which we in our organization deal. Illicit money flowing out of developing countries is estimated at somewhere between $850 billion to more than $1 trillion a year. This is roughly 10 times the amount of foreign aid that has traditionally been going into developing countries in recent years. Illicit money is money that is illegally earned, illegally transferred, or illegally utilized. We just collapsed.
See what happens when you come up with shocking figures?
If money breaks laws in its origin, movement, or use, it merits the label illegal. It comes in three forms. First, the proceeds of bribery and theft by government officials. Second, the proceeds of criminal activity, such as drug trading and racketeering and counterfeiting and so forth. And third, the proceeds of commercial tax evasion. Now, in producing an estimate such as this, we utilized well-established economic formulas that have been around for a long time, namely the World Bank residual method and IMF direction of trade statistics. These models have been used by dozens of economists over a period of decades. these models helped us get an indication that the proceeds of bribery and theft, which we normally refer to as corruption, and I'm talking about the cross-border flow of illicit money, proceeds of bribery and theft are about 3% of the global total. Proceeds of criminal activities are about 30 to 35% of the global total, and the proceeds of commercial tax evasion are about 60 to 65% of the global total. We were simply the first organization to take these two models, the World Bank residual method and IMF direction of trade statistics, and apply them to the data available from all reporting developing countries to the World Bank and the IMF. We think the figure of roughly $1 trillion a year is quite conservative, because it does not include smuggling, and it does not include the mispricing of certain kinds of transactions, including services and intellectual property, which have become the favored areas for mispricing over the last 15 or 20 years. This money flowing out of developing countries passes through a shadow financial system that now comprises a number of elements. This system was developed by us in the West, not by the countries out of which the money comes. And it was developed primarily from the 1960s forward. The 1960s marked the takeoff point in the development of this structure for two reasons. One, it was the decade of decolonization. Between the late 1950s and the end of the 1960s, 48 countries gained their independence. And some of the economic and political elites in those countries wanted to take their money out. And we in the West serviced that desire for flight capital very creatively. The 1960s also marked the decade when multinational corporations really began to spread their flags all across the planet. And many multinational corporations utilize tax evading and money laundering techniques to shift profits abroad. This system now comprises tax havens, more than 60 around the world. Secrecy jurisdictions, these are places where you can establish an entity behind nominees and trustees such that no one knows who really owns the business. These disguised corporations now number in the millions around the world. Anonymous trust accounts are part of this structure. Fake foundations are part of this structure. You can create a charitable foundation. You can give money to the charitable foundation, and you can designate yourself as the beneficiary of the charity of this foundation, of course, evading taxes at every step along the way. Falsified documentation is used in all sorts of transactions. Falsified pricing in imports and exports is by far the most frequently used component of this structure. And then there are money laundering techniques that facilitate the movement of particular kinds of resources across borders. And then finally, there are holes left in the laws of Western countries that facilitate the movement of money through this shadow financial system and ultimately into our own Western economies. You might be surprised to know that it remains legal to bring into the United States criminal proceeds generated abroad from handling stolen property, counterfeiting, contraband, credit fraud, environmental crimes, all kinds of tax evading money, and more. That and more can come legally into the United States. This structure and the estimated, conservatively estimated, $1 trillion a year of money that it moves out of developing countries is, in our judgment, the most damaging economic condition hurting the global poor. It drains hard currency reserves, heightens inflation, reduces tax collection, cancels investment, and undermines free trade. It has its most damaging effect on the picture of poverty and inequality around the world. What you have here are two bar charts showing the two usual ways of measuring global income. One is based on purchasing power parity. The other one is based on currency exchange rates. In each bar chart, each color represents 20% of the world's population. look at how much of global income flows to the top 20% of the world and how little of global income is available to the bottom 80% of the world. We're talking about 70 to 90% of global income by either measure flowing to the top 20%, leaving only 10 to 30% of global income for the bottom 80%. I want you to understand something. The major purpose of the shadow financial system that I've been talking about and the movement of money out of developing countries, the major motivation driving this phenomenon is the shift of money from poor to rich. This is about taking money from the 80% and shifting it into the 20%, taking money out of the countries where 80% of the world's population lives and shifting it into places where 20% of the world's population lives. Now, we have also done an analysis of illicit financial flows out of Africa, as Princeton has referred to. And across that 39 period, yes, our estimate is that somewhere between roughly a little over $800 billion a year to $1.8 trillion a year has passed out in that 39-year period. We think that's an extremely conservative estimate because there's a great deal of years in the 70s and 80s, particularly, when there's no data available. And if there's no data, we don't make it up and plug it in there. We're talking only about what appears in the data. But let's take the most recent year, 2008, as an example. Our data indicates that roughly something on the order of $90 billion to $169 billion has passed out of Africa illicitly, unrecorded, during the year 2008 alone. Again, we think this is conservative because it does not include some major elements by which money is moved. Now, contrast this to foreign aid, which has been running $40, $45 billion a year or so. We're talking about a ratio that is somewhere between 2 and 4 times the amount of foreign aid going into Africa. It is less than the 10 times figure globally because the foreign aid figure is so much higher, is disproportionately higher as compared to the rest of the world. The divisor is higher. So it's a 2 to 4 times ratio compared to foreign aid. Now, we also have the ability to analyze this by countries. We can do this on a country-by-country basis. If you take the last, 7 years or so, and look at what the data shows. We're not making this up. This is what the two formulas, the World Bank residual method and IMF direction of trade statistics, indicate. Nigeria has peaked to some $50 billion in the year 2008. Angola is surprisingly small, and I don't quite understand why those numbers are as small as they are. Perhaps Rafael will give us more insight into how money is taken out of Angola, but we're talking about enormous sums of money. Nigeria is a very large part of the total amount of money that has come illicitly out of Africa. Let me close my remarks at the point where I more often than not begin my remarks. 2010 is the 49th year of my involvement in Nigeria, in Africa, and in the developing countries. I, as Princeton said, lived 15 years in Nigeria, did business all over the rest of the developing world for another 20 years. After 35 years in business, segued into the think tank community as a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. Across these years, I think I have probably seen more money laundering, more financial crime, more corruption, certainly than any one person should see in a lifetime. And I finally decided to say what I had to say about this phenomenon. Across these years, I've been a very sharp critic of corruption in developing countries. Having said that, I am an equally sharp critic of the facilitating role played by Western countries in the movement of both corrupt and other forms of illicit money out of developing countries. If we really want to fight corruption, if we really want to help Nuhu and Rafael fight corruption in their countries and help other people fight corruption in their countries, we have to clean up our part of the act. Fighting corruption is a two-way street. Thank you.
Thank you, Raymond. I always find your presentations extraordinarily provocative, but also depressing. But I do want you to come back, and all our panelists to come back with some suggestions about steps we can take on this, because I think you're putting your finger on something that we don't deal with a lot, and I feel very strongly about this two-way aspect of corruption, and I'm glad you're putting that front and center. I want to turn to Rafael Marques. He is a well-known, established human rights advocate in Angola. He was representing the OSI there. He has written and worked on human rights throughout his life. He's been active in organizing parties, opposition parties, when it was hard to develop those. He's won numerous awards. He's a courageous journalist. He's a courageous human rights advocate, and he has spoken out on the issues that we're discussing today. So, Rafael, it's my pleasure to have you speak to us.
Thank you, Ambassador Lyman, and the Council on Foreign Relations for this opportunity to address you this morning. And thank you, Raymond and Nuhu, for sharing this panel with me. I'd like just to make a little remark on your comments. I've been engaged in helping building up civil society, not political parties. Have never been affiliated to one.
Okay.
Sorry. During our civil wars, the government of Angola consistently pointed to corruption as the second major destructive force in the country after the civil war. Ironically, in times of peace, corruption has become the most defining issue in governing the nation. It is a common part of business and government relationships. It has taken root throughout our social fabric. It is so pervasive, by the end of 2009, President José Eduardo dos Santos declared a zero tolerance policy against the scourge, a sinister attempt to deflect attention to the problem and to appease his detractors. Since October last year, I set up a website to monitor corruption in government in the context of the country's legal framework, and in order to examine how it is affecting the functionality of the state. I have identified four major areas of corruption. These are the transfer of state assets to top government officials through privatization, the assignment of public contracts to companies owned and often managed by top government officials, joint ventures between multinationals, top government officials, and generals as an imperative of foreign investment, and the multi-billion dollar loans coming from China. President dos Santos, who's been in power for 30 years, has been commonly viewed as the epicenter of corruption in government. His recent declaration of zero tolerance policy does not outline any concrete steps to combat corruption, except for the approval of a new law whose main articles already exist in other legal documents. This new law was approved on March 30 of this year. Furthermore, the new constitution, which came into effect on February 3, 2010, also ends the role of the parliament to monitor the executive and the power to call on the government for hearings. Thus, the Angolan political system of checks and balances under the new constitution has been severely curtailed as the result of lack of accountability to parliament. The new constitution concentrates far more powers in the hands of the president than during the Marxist-Leninist dictatorship, which vigorated in the country from 75 to 91. and also ends presidential elections. In September 2008, the ruling MPLA party won the second legislative elections by a landslide with 82% of the total votes, thus enabling it to change the constitution at will. So the new constitution signals the return of a one-party system, a safe state in the country with a veneer of democratic legitimacy. It is in this political context that the country needs to address the paradox of having one of the fastest growing economies in the world and the worsening of its human development index. From 1998 to 2007, the country experienced an annual GDP growth of 10%, while poverty and income inequality steadily worsened, with 70% of the population living on less than $2 a day for the period of 2000 to 2007, according to the World Bank figures. Meanwhile, public spending increased tenfold between 2002, the year the war finally ended, and 2007, from $7.4 billion to $43 billion. Angola's economy continues to be almost exclusively dependent on oil, with exports reaching a record of $62 billion in 2008, thus representing 97.7% of the total exports, according to the World Bank. While billions of dollars are pouring through the hands and accounts of corrupt officials, ordinary Angolans are living in extreme poverty. They're hungry, without decent education, jobs, or health care. Mass evictions from poor dwellings and relocation to tented camps with worse conditions have also become a regular feature in main cities to make land available for private development projects by the ruling elite. What is extraordinary in Angola is the open way in which government officials loot the state. For instance, from 1992 to 2008, through the Council of Ministers Resolution 991, the management of the national oil company, Sonangol, transferred 10% of shares of its wholly owned research and production unit, which holds shares in the oil blocks, for the illicit enrichment of a few members of the ruling elite. This group, which has collected hundreds of millions of dollars from the 10% shares, was represented by the then chairman of Sonangol, Miss Albina Sish. She became Minister of Petroleum from 92 to 99, and last Tuesday she was appointed to the board of Sonangol Group. By July 2008, the chairman and CEO of Sonangol, Mr. Manuel Vicente, who is regarded here as one of the main reformers in the country, reshuffled the company to illegally award himself 1% of Sonangol. Most recently, the government privatized the public-owned mobile operator Movicel without any public bid to a group of companies, some created overnight, that belonged to ministers concerned and other members of the ruling elite. There is no record that the companies that benefited paid the state a penny. These cases highlight a deep contradiction in what is happening in reality and what the foreign partners of the government of Angola, like the United States, are publicly stating. While looting of state assets has increased, the U.S. keeps reiterating publicly that the country is moving towards transparency and democracy. To support their position, U.S. officials state that the Ministry of Finance of Angola discloses on its website the oil revenues and that an officer of the U.S. Treasury is assisting the Angolan Central Bank to organize its bookkeeping system. On democracy, it is being viewed that elections were a positive development in spite of a new constitution that sends us back to the dark days of a one-party state. However, this contradiction reflects a clear attitude to grant legitimacy to the regime. As I heard from a Washington risk analyst, 2 days ago. Corruption in Angola is easier to deal with because it is centralized. While in Nigeria, for instance, it is decentralized. And many more in Nigeria demand their share. Furthermore, he argued that it is common view in Washington that the Angolan regime has a tighter grip on power, thus guaranteeing political stability by sheer force, unlike in Nigeria. My view is that Nigeria, with all its problems, is building state institutions that can survive presidents. A case in point is the way in which state institutions guaranteed the naming of Mr. Goodluck Jonathan as acting president, while President Yar'Adua battles ill health. In the case of Angola, the only guarantee of stability seems to be the person of President Dos Santos. Cult of personality has replaced state building. So what can be done to combat corruption? First, Angolans need full information to be able to craft responses to the problem. The state controls the media with national outreach, while the relevant private media sector is now in the hands of leading members of the regime. And what is not controlled by the state is either being driven out of business or has caved in to censorship for survival. Only with increased and reliable information, Angolans will be able to respond to watchdog and take action in orderly and constructive fashion. Second, what could the U.S. government do? The U.S. has far more leverage in Angola than it may think it has. It is one of the main oil importers. Oil drives U.S. policy towards Angola as it embodies Angola's foreign policy. The government of Angola cares what the U.S. thinks of it. The U.S. could help support the need for full information and the independent voices trying to strengthen our chance at democracy by holding the government accountable to the laws of the land to combat corruption. Ultimately, only Angolans can effectively establish whether the country is moving towards transparency and democracy or not. And I thank you for your attention.
Rafael, thank you so much. Now we're going to turn to Nuhu Rabadu. Many of you know him, a graduate of law school, 18 years with the police in Nigeria, then became director of the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission of Nigeria. He did such a outstanding job in going after corruption that he was told to leave the country, a little more forcefully than that. He has won also numerous awards. He is recognized as one of not only the important persons leading the fight against corruption, but one of the best analysts of it. He is recently won Man of the Year Award from the World Bank. He is currently at the Center for Global Development, and perhaps there's a pathway back now for him to assume that very good work in Nigeria. But Nuhu, over to you.
Do I need to touch anything? Yes, okay. Thank you, Ambassador Lyman, for this wonderful introduction. And I hope that I'll go back like you're suggesting. Things are changing in Nigeria, and it looks like God really loves us. And at a point when you would think that things will no hope, then suddenly something will happen. And then you see us coming up again. So I would want to say that maybe God is a Nigerian, and we are lucky for that. But thank you for this wonderful, early morning. This is my earliest day, earliest in ever in Washington, D.C. And I was just complaining just before we got in here that I have not slept in the last, probably 48 hours, and for me to get in here and this amazing crowd. So I don't know. You see, I've come nothing, and I'm just gonna carry on and see what probably I can follow with what Raymond said and then Rafael just shared with us. It's amazing what we've heard from Raymond. It underscores the whole problem, fundamental issue of a continent that has been unable to really do anything for itself, even with huge resources that is internally generated or that flows into the continent and literally goes out in folds. It's amazing. But Nigeria is a country that you can say the best example for that. Even United Nations alone, UNODC came up with a figure that as much as about $400 billion went out of Nigeria in the last four decades. It's amazing. This is money that is supposed to go to help us address our own problems, but it's out. And there's nothing you can do without money. Money that you either generate yourself or that comes in to assist you. But this is the story of Africa. And like what Rafael said in his own conclusion, it is going to be just we. If there is hope, if there is chance, it has to come from we, the Africans, the Nigerians, the Angolans, that will be able to make the difference. And that's my story, basically, to share with you. You have heard those things that they have just said, and I will just share with you what we attempted to do. Some of us who somehow disagreed with the way things were and were sufficiently angry and attempted to do something with it. And it's my story, it's my life, it's exactly what I have lived all my life. I graduated from the law school in 1983, and I decided to join the Nigerian Police Force. My belief then, and I still have it, and I still stand by that, is we've mismanaged ourselves unbelievable. We need to change, and no one else could do it apart from us. The story of Africa is just a terrible tragedy. Just look at the continent. Maybe two-thirds of the countries have gone through horrendous, at times, point of genocide, conflicts. A continent that produced probably the Mobutus of this world, the Abaches of this world, the Idi Amins of this, the Bokassa of this world, the Said Barres of this world, the Samuel Doe's of this world, the Mugabe's of this world. One small little part of the world that has produced unbelievable example of everything that is bad. And it is ongoing and it is continuing. It is a continent that has been left behind, far, far. The world has moved so fast and we are just being, and unfortunately we are continuously retrogressing simply because the way we manage ourselves. Until that change, we are not likely going to see solutions to the problems that are confronting Africa. Few of us thought we could do something. And there are so many around and across the continent. And my story is that of in Nigeria. I had a chance in 2003 to do something, a couple of us. And we came, young Nigerians, and confronted it in the most difficult way. And that's what I want to share. What can the world do and what we from the African part could do? And possibly if we come together, the possibilities of addressing this problem. The world did a lot, I can tell you, to address this problem of corruption. From what the UN has done in terms of coming up with appropriate laws, encouragement, World Bank, international organizations, financial institutions, Western world, particularly United States, came up with strongest laws as far back as in the 70s in addressing problem of their own companies and citizens doing business outside the United States. Some strong measures have been taken. The same thing with OECD. Somehow, not much has been achieved or difference. We witnessed in the last decade emergence of anti-corruption initiatives within the continent. Couple of countries came up with agencies. Some of them did this simply because it was just really attractive. It will win them friends across the world, the Western world particularly. And indeed, in some countries, it will even make them popular internally because the people realize that, that was the fundamental problem that had to be addressed. We had the emergence of anti-corruption agencies, for example, in South Africa, in Kenya, in Zambia, Tanzania, Nigeria, and so on and so forth. Sadly, most, if not all of them today, you can say not a single one that is functioning. The scorpions in South Africa is gone. The Anti-Corruption Commission in Kenya is almost in comatose. The same thing with Zambia, where those who led some very impressive war, I mean fight, have all ended up in the same situation where I am today. We have seen also a couple of things, for example, new rules, new tools to address issues of transparency and accountability. For example, public procurement institutions coming up across the country, fiscal responsibility initiatives, laws, EITI, and so on. So many things came up. And to some extent, they made a lot of difference across the continent. But it looks like as if the political leadership suddenly realized that it's not in their own best interest to go that direction. They retrogressed, they moved back, and almost killed the entire initiative that started about a decade ago. We are almost getting back to square one. And that's why I want to just tell you what happened in Nigeria. FATF put pressure on Nigeria, blacklisted Nigeria between 2002-2003 that led us to have an money laundering law or regime that also involved setting up a commission to more or less administer those laws. I had the chance to lead it. I was the first chairman, and it was an opportunity that we were waiting for. We took it and we built it properly. Anti-money laundering initiatives has a way of addressing most of the problems that Raymond just shared with us. Go after the money. Ability to have like an umbrella through which you will control all sorts of the predicate offenses that necessitate flow of money out of the system, whether it is the country, government, or even the private sector. We use it effectively. And it brought change within Nigeria in the country within a short period of time. We were able to link up and connect with the world and got support fundamentally from the most important countries that has a relation with us. I mean, for example, UK and the US. We got them to understand that for you to support Africa and particularly countries like Nigeria, the best way is for you to see how you can stop this flow of money. We got Metropolitan Police, for example, to start taking action against those who are taking this money and then taking it into their own jurisdictions. And within a short period of time, we started seeing a change. Metropolitan Police, for example, took three more very important cases on behalf of the EFCC. They arrested three governors. All these three governors, they made them with money in excess of each over £1 million in cash, not to talk of the properties and so on. But the magic about it is that the moment they started going after them, it sent a signal to the rest of Nigerians who thought that, you know, that it will continue to be safe haven for them to take the money out of our own jurisdiction and keep it in London and across. We saw in 2005, as much as about 10 billion was going out of Nigeria directly from that source, from what Raymond shared with you. But in 2006, as a result of the action they took, we saw an inflow of about $15 billion. And we recorded it. We have records of that from the EFCC. I thought these are some of the things that I could share with you to show that even little effort in small initiative will make a massive difference. That $15 billion that went into Nigeria in 2006 was responsible for the capitalization of the of the capital market in Nigeria. It was responsible for recapitalization of most of the banking sector in Nigeria. It was part of the money that was used to also buy some of the privatized companies that Nigeria. And the money came from those who took it from Nigeria, basically. The governors, we had, for example, a governor of Edo State bringing in close to about $500 million to come and buy a bank. We had James Ibori coming in, who is also a governor of Delta State, who brought in about close to about $600 million to buy Wilbros, an American company that was divesting out of Nigeria, to buy a fertilizer company in Port Harcourt that was privatized, and a couple of things. That money helped to, at least even if it is stolen, but it got back, and then it somehow helped to more or less keep the economy moving. So those are some of the little steps that we took. But the fundamental thing that I want to share with you is that it must be, first and foremost, the support that comes out, comes in from international community must meet on ground a ready measure or attitude internally that will be able to make a difference. The difference that it made in Nigeria is simply because some of us were there on ground. We took those laws, whether it came from FATF or the United Nations, and worked hard to build the structures and institutions for enforcement and carrying out all those things that we that we could make a difference. The measures that we took in Nigeria somehow was responsible, even for the basic simple things, for example, getting Nigeria debt sort of buyback in 2005, 2006, as a result of which Nigeria got about 18 billion of its own debts from the international debt credit source offer. And some of the things that we took, even though the political will as at that time allowed it, with the leadership Obasanjo gave, almost is the responsible for some of the things that we are witnessing today in our own country. Those measures that were taken internally change the country fundamentally. We knew that when you fight corruption, it will fight you back, and it fought back. Some of us lost, a couple of our own people were killed. I got myself kicked out. I have been out of the country in the last close to 2 years, but there's a change going on in the country today, really, and that I don't think Nigeria is going to be the same again, simply because of some of the things that took place between 2003 and 2007. My point here is that internally, there has to be some form of measures. People will have to wake up and stand and start making it possible for us to really have those fundamental things that are needed to change us. The world, I don't want to be putting the blame outside the world. I don't think that we'll get anywhere if we continue to say that the Western world or the international are partly responsible. No, they are not. It is we. And it is the same thing, for example, what is happening today with our relation with China and so on. The Western world did so much in addressing their own problems and making it impossible for their own people, their own companies, to continue to do the bad things in Africa and in Nigeria. But the fact that we are not ready. We don't want that. We don't want you to even help us. Our leaders, those who are in charge of our own affairs, feel that that is not the way they want things, and they are not ready to continue with that direction. They are not ready to see that you implement your Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. They are now going to China, and they are not going to those who want to continue with the business as usual. And like what Raphael said, it's real. When I was in Nigeria, I tried to, because I realized that the Western companies, more or less, you could not get much when it comes to corruption. It's not them at all. I've investigated most of the companies that were doing business, particularly like American companies, in Nigeria. I can assure you they are probably the best you can get in that part of the world. Nothing much, really. Those few ones that we were able to identify things, we reach out to the law enforcement here, FBI particularly, and Justice Department, and they were able to bring them to justice, as a result of which about 20-something companies were investigated. Part of them, you can say Panalpina, Siemens, Halliburton, they all came from our own initiative. And justice also to tell you that whatever is going to happen, whatever even outside world will want to help us, it has to come as a form of initiative from our own side. We saw the difference. Today, some of these companies were penalized. As much as about close to $2 billion was taken from them by the United States government. Almost all this came from us. But the point I'm trying to make is that as we were doing that, the Nigerian government somehow found that, you know, these are the people that they will not do business with. Most of the new things that is coming up in terms of whether transactions and whether it is oil blocks or new concessions, most of it is going to the Chinese now. Why? It's simply because in the first instance, we could not even get to talk to Chinese government to do what we did with the United States. Two, the Chinese, and indeed even Indians to some extent, are not yet there where the Western world is. Three, the leadership in Africa, and as exemplified by Nigeria, probably Angola, Sudan, are looking for those people who are ready to do business with them behind, under the table. Until when we have leadership that is really ready to understand that there is need for us to have a change, it's not likely that we may see much impact or difference, and we'll be able to reverse some of the things that we heard from Raymond this morning. The continuous flow of this money, money that goes in, few people will come from outside, assist the leaders, and continue to take it out, deny the continent the use of it. And like you said, Rafael, Nigeria, it is decentralized. It's true, but Angola will get there. We were not before. Early, probably in the 70s, it was just leaders who are doing it. But when you allow corruption, a little window to get in, it will take over. It will take over the engine of the society. It will take over your private sector. It will indeed run your own system, your own affairs. Nigeria has got to that point. Sadly, that is the case. I hope and I pray that Angola will not get to that situation. But I can assure you that it is only we Africans, only us will be able to make the difference. The earlier we get to realize that, the better it is. And the world will come in and support. And I've, for example, tried to even talk, for example, with the UNODC. We worked with them in trying to implement the ANCAR law and take it across the continent. And when we got into trouble, some of us like me and Maxwell and so on, up to now, I've never got even one single phone call from the United UNODC. And I said, you are making a huge mistake, because you can never make a difference unless you get those people you can partner with. Those people, physical people who are going to do the work on ground. Identify them, support them, and make whatever you can do to ensure that you have more and more of such people. Physical people on ground who are going to take on this issue. It's a big, big problem. It's actually underestimated. It's far, far bigger than what you could imagine. Zimbabwe is what it is today simply because of corruption. If we are not careful, South Africa is going to go that direction. As we see what is going on in Angola, if it is not addressed, Angola will end up like Nigeria. The rest of the continent, wherever you have resources, is going to end up like Congo, like Nigeria, and indeed like Sudan. Even those who are, for now, not yet there. So, and I think I will just keep quiet here. So, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Nehua. Thank you all. To start us off on this discussion, I'm going to ask you, Ray. Nehua and Rafael have both emphasized the changes that needed to be done in Africa, the leadership that's needed, and the support that can be given. What are some of the things you think can be done to get at that systematic problem that you're identifying so clearly?
Thank you, Princeton. Let me give you two or three examples of what can be done to address the systemic problem. One is knowledge of beneficial ownership of all those disguised entities that exist around the world. There, Senator Levin has put an incorporation transparency bill on the table, seeking very modestly to open up state registries in the United States, state registries of corporations to law enforcement officials. Right now, there are many entities that law enforcement officials cannot find out the beneficial ownership of such entities. To me, it makes no sense. Every financial institution, every country ought to know who owns the entities with which it or the country is doing business. I made this comment in New York not long ago, and a Wall Street banker in the back of the room raised his hand and said, "Do you have any idea how much it would cost us to determine the beneficial ownership of all the accounts that we have in the bank?" Of course, the answer is it costs nothing. You put the shoe on the other foot. It's the responsibility of the account holder to identify who is the beneficial owner. Under penalty of making a false declaration to the bank, the account gets frozen, et cetera. It is not that difficult. Of course, you will have a few people that will continue to try to operate an account without identifying the beneficial owner. But you get to the heart of the problem. You get to the essence of the problem with knowledge of beneficial ownership. Secondly, predicate offenses. The United States, let me back up a minute. All of those things that underlie a money laundering charge, and I talked to you about the kinds of criminal offenses committed abroad, the money of which can come legally into the United States. The United States began the anti-money laundering effort in the 1980s. And the United States has now fallen far behind its European colleagues in the range of what we bar coming from abroad. That needs to be changed. And Senator Grassley, in the last two legislative sessions, not the current one, has put a bill on the table to do exactly that, to change what is covered under U.S. anti-money laundering law to make it refer to any major crime, whether committed in the United States or outside the United States. And that simply gets the U.S. position closer into alignment with the European position. A third thing that can be done is move toward automatic exchange of tax information across borders. We have something closely resembling that in our relationships with Canada. Another example, of course, is in the European Union. The European Union figured out a long time ago that it can't function if a citizen of one country can have an interest-bearing account in another country and doesn't pay taxes on either account. So the European Union passed what is called the EU Savings Tax Directive, whereby information on those kinds of earnings is exchanged automatically among EU countries. That kind of pattern we need to move toward in the United States. Hacienda in Mexico recently wrote a letter to the U.S. Treasury Department asking to have with the United States the same kind of an arrangement that the United States has with Canada, which, as I say, gets pretty close to automatic exchange. To the best of my knowledge, that letter was almost a year ago. To the best of my knowledge, Treasury has not answered that letter yet.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you all. I have a lot of questions, but I'm going to resist and open it up to members of our audience. And if you turn your card on the right hand, you turn it up, and then I can tell who's coming. And let me start with Tony Carroll. And just identify
Tony Carroll
yourself.
Of Manchester Trade, perhaps to you, Raymond. Not captured in your data, which is extraordinary, and I thank you for your contributions, is, of course, a slice of incoming flows, which are remittances. I do a lot of work in the remittance community, particularly for the Somalis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have increasingly difficult times in getting monies, which many communities depend upon, back into Somalia. Because of the increasing tightness of anti-money laundering regulations, FinCEN bank investigations and periodic audits. So how do we devise a system and strengthen what you're seeking, which is a greater tracking of these illicit flows, but on the same time allow enough space in the system to allow these remittances flowing back to Africa, which have, of course, a vital impact on communities. And same in Nigeria as well.
You want to answer that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Glad you drew attention to remittances. It is generating considerable inflow, and I'm all for that. Interestingly, that is not the return of flight capital. Yeah. It is, for the most part, wages and salaries.
For the most
people.
Part.
Yeah, for the most part. It's money from family members who've gone abroad. We have been pushing the World Bank, with apologies to Katie, we've been pushing the World Bank to address the whole of the external equation for development, all financial flows that are in and out externally, both the illicit money going out and FDI and remittances and coming in and so forth. World Bank has never done this. Across the last half century, the World Bank has never put on the table the whole of the financial equation affecting its ability to meet its mission. We find that unacceptable, and we push the World Bank to address all parts of inflows and outflows in order to come up with this. We don't honestly ask you or anybody else to accept our figures. We encourage everybody else to do their own figures. If you don't like the two models that we've used, use any other models that get at this. But let's examine the whole of the financial equation, the external equation affecting development. That's the element that has been outstanding, unaddressed in development policy for a half century.
Yeah.
Julia? Identify yourself for the...
Okay, I'm Julia Fromholtz with Human Rights First. And thank you all very much. This was a fascinating discussion. Not surprisingly, all of you focused a lot on what the governments and the international community could do or what role they play in corruption. I think it was Mr. Ribaudo, you mentioned the EITI, and there are other voluntary mechanisms that exist. They may be, I think they're flawed and not, but there's the EITI and the voluntary principles and the Kimberley process and others that are at least attempts by the private sector to have some effect on corruption in Africa. I'm wondering, one of the things that is a puzzle is those voluntary mechanisms tend to focus just on multinationals because of the reputational risk that they face in the Western community.
Yeah.
Is there, and so the puzzle is, how does one, can anyone in the developed world try to affect the smaller commercial entities that are operating and that are part of corruption, part of the corrupt chain in Africa? They probably wouldn't become part of these voluntary mechanisms because they don't have the same reputational risk. Do you see any way that we here can try to build institutions or something that would affect those commercial entities that are part of the corrupt chain?
Well, you are right. And usually, you know, somehow most of these measures really are just directed towards the companies that are mostly Western. And you are right. That's why they are probably having the best practices across wherever you see them in the continent. And this is the challenge. How do we just take it to the other part, onto the other side? My take here is simply it has to do with, like, those who are in charge of our own affairs. In Africa, what matters is government, basically. And if you have a good government, chances are everything will work, including also taking it to where we are talking about, and the rest will come along as well. Sadly, we don't have that mostly, and it's an issue that I will not want. I probably will not say that we have one single solution to. It has to do with what hope do we have? The emergence of fairly good leadership across. It is happening gradually, little by little, but very slow. And we attempted, for example, to do exactly what you are talking about in Nigeria. We brought in most of those things, voluntary sometimes, charters, whether it is EITI, whether it is FATA, whether it is all those things. And we moved them, not just within Western companies. We actually took them to the business, direct. But sadly, you know, a government got in 2007 and literally reversed everything that we have done. Today, with the initiatives, the EITI, we tried and attempted and successfully introduced in Nigeria. At a point, we were probably number one in the world. I've just been told that Sierra Leone has just scaled through as number two in the EITI list after Ajibaja. Why is it happening? It's simply because of leadership of Salif Johnson in Liberia. It tells you about how much, so much we are dependent on just leadership. It's sad. It's so simplistic, but it's really the case. We have been strangulated. We have been controlled. We are literally nothing without that good quality leadership. If it works, it's simply because it is allowed. If it is not good leadership, chances are nothing will enter. It's a very horrible thing that I really don't know what to say. And we will continue to struggle and see how far. But you cannot do much, basically. The world has done everything you can imagine. I continue to be a big advocate of that the West did extremely well. You have done everything you could imagine. Never feel bad about it. You have done extremely well. Honestly, we are the failures. Sadly, that is the case. And until we wake up and realize that it is we, the whole thing, it is the gap is from our own side. And we start becoming serious. How we do it is the biggest challenge. Hopefully it will come.
I'm gonna call on other people, but I'm going to put out a question that I'd like you to come back to, both of you, because a Nigerian colleague said to me the other day, when we were talking about leadership, he said, even if you got a good leader in place, the system would eat that person up sooner or later. The demands of the politics and the money, et cetera, would gradually break down that commitment. So I want to come back a little bit later on the systemic problems in the way both the economy and the political system are structured and how any leader can take that on, or a group of leaders. But I know there are several people. Maybe I'll take two or three questions. We have Henry there, back there in the corner, and Travis, and then I'll come back to you, Harry. So, Henry, and identify yourself, please.
Certainly. Henry Crumpton from the Crumpton Group. What is your advice, practical advice, for investors or companies seeking to do business in Africa, particularly Nigeria and Angola?
Okay, that's good.
Sorry, I can't see. Joe
Bell. Joe Bell, Hogan & Hartson, Revenue Watch. Mr. DeMora has pointed out that one of the ways of corruption, of course, is the giving away of very valuable franchises or other interests. Not something uncommon elsewhere. Post-Soviet Union, we had all this whole phenomenon of privatization when state assets are given away. But that doesn't show up in the same way as illicit financial flows. And I was curious, particularly from Mr. Baker's point of view, as to what, if anything, from his perspective, can be done about that form of corruption, which actually can transfer vast amounts of wealth without showing up in some way as a corrupted flow.
And then Travis.
How are you? I'm Travis Atkins. I'm an incoming International Affairs Fellow here at the Council on Foreign Relations. In my question, I wanted to do two things. One, I wanted to challenge a little bit Nuhu and also draw out Mr. Baker on an issue that you guys seem to have a little bit of disagreement about. While I would agree that the primary responsibility for governance issues in Nigeria is obviously the government of Nigeria, I think at the same time the West is on really shaky ground to castigate a practice which they so readily facilitate. So even though it's not an either-or proposition, and you know the weight of it is on the Nigerian government, could we also speak a little bit to the role that the West does play in making that practice continually more profitable?
So we have advice to investors, the specific issue of franchises, and then Travis's question on this balance. Rafael, could I ask you to start?
Please. I think one practical advice, given the trend in Angola, and I speak briefly on Angola, I think is to make sure that the companies that investors deal with are not associated to government officials and other elements of the ruling elite, as the law forbids that. So one issue that I have addressed in several articles is that usually investors prefer give priority to companies that have government officials or generals, because that opens up the doors and also facilitates the impunity of the companies in terms of doing business, tax evasion, and all sorts of things happening in the country. And then it is very easier in the case of Angola, because international institutions for years have been writing that there are basically no laws on corruption. It was on the State Department website, and it's still there, that basically Angola has no laws on corruption, which is misguiding, because the laws have always been in place. They just have never been used. So it's a question of having a knowledge of the laws and making sure that the companies respect the laws of the land. Mm-hmm. That would be a step forward. And that also ties to the question of Joe Bell about the corruption flow and these new trends. What Angolan officials have realized is that there is a tightening in the financial system in Western countries, like the former governor of the central bank was mentioned in the report of the, in a recent report in the Senate for having tried to siphon away to U.S. bank accounts $100 million. And I think it was Citibank that prevented that happening. So what these individuals now are doing are taking that money and associating themselves with the reputable Western companies and investing it in the country, being shareholders in oil blocks, buying companies, setting up another system that has become now quite as a gateway to the international financial system is the setting up of banks. Any respectable corrupt official now owns a bank. So, and that bank enters into the international financial system.
Yeah.
It's one way of doing that. And again, just also on how Western governments facilitate corruption. And in that regard, I also have a slight disagreement with Nuhu, or a different view on what is happening in Angola.
Yeah.
Western governments are keen in supporting or facilitating the stability of the regime. Therefore, for instance, many bilateral agreements provide protection for foreign investment. And that protection includes protection also for the illegal ways of doing business.
Mm.
For instance, openly Portuguese banks, which is part of the European Union, have as shareholders, ministers, and other major shareholders who are members of the government. And that is illegal according to the Angolan laws. But then we have the question of bilateral agreements trying to supersede national laws. So it's one way that should be addressed as well, how sometimes governments in their bilateral relations provide a kind of cover for corruption. And just also to go back very briefly in a minute to Julia's question on EITI and the Kimberley process. It's also another example of how these initiatives have to be taken country by country. In the case of Angola, the Kimberley process has created a major problem. The companies responsible for major human rights abuses, ongoing human rights abuses, are the same companies that have the stamps to declare the diamonds clean and basically certify them as clean with the Kimberley process. And I had a meeting 2 days ago with Julia, and I just explained, I was 2 weeks ago in the diamond region visiting and doing some research there. And I stumbled on a case in which the army buried alive 45 artisanal miners. And one private security company hacked one individual to death. But what happens is that Angola chairs the group, the Kimberley Process Group on Artisanal Mining. Mm. So the country that at the moment is committing more human rights abuses is the country that chairs and defines what Kimberley Process should do on artisanal mining. And these issues are not addressed because what happens is sometimes we take two or three good examples, like in Sierra Leone and Nigeria, and transfer it across the continent as if everything is going fine, then giving support to some governments to continue with their abuses just because others have done well. And the world wants a very good example of how a project is being successful.
Yeah. So, well, thank you. Just to follow on what Rafael said, all what he said is just right. And particularly to advice to business, I mean, those who want to do business in Africa, I think follow, I mean, respect the laws. And the laws are out there. Your home country laws, for example, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, of the U.S., OECD, they have rules, World Bank, they are all out there advising you on how best you can conduct yourselves. I think people should take them serious. Two, when you are on ground, also respect the laws of the countries, whatever they are. Three, avoid the fact that you will just go the direction what used to be, that you need somebody in government to be part of you for you to be able to do it. And you, we've seen it happen before, either bringing in their families as members of the company and so on. It doesn't work. Eventually, it will backfire. Three, avoid dodgy people in the country, those who will maybe give you way to go around things and shortcuts, and whether it is to do with customs issues, whether to do with immigration issues, whatever it is, please do the right thing. And I'm saying this based on my own experience as a physical person who addressed this problem. It's not, Rafael, my point is, I have experienced this thing.
Yes.
And Nigeria is a very big laboratory for you to really check all these things. Everything happened there. And I'm very serious about what I said. It's our own problem. The West, we tend to push blame always, and we are losing because of that. The Western world did extremely well, to be honest. And they have taken all measures that ordinarily everybody is expected to take. We resist it, and we continue to resist it. Even the Kimberley process, you could see exactly, it is a big success story. But continuously, internally, we provide all the challenges. We continue to pour, and the failures come from our own side. Most of the failures are on our own side. And I'm just telling us that we should wake up and come to understand that we shouldn't blame. I don't want to talk about blaming any Western country, to be honest. From my experience, I've investigated companies doing business in Nigeria. The biggest oil companies in the world are in Nigeria. I have checked their books. I've seen how they conducted their businesses. I can tell you they are the best. And at a point, I was very comfortable. Wherever I see, whether it is Mobil or Exxon or anything involved in a transaction, or Chevron, I would not bother myself to go further, because they have really, over the years, come to really some basics of their own procedures and the processes and their own transactions. Wherever I see a Chinese company, I go in there. Wherever I go, I see an Indian company, I go there, or a Russian company, and that is where the challenges are, and why our people go out to look for them to even come, because it's so difficult to do business with. Is it Chevron? Which one is your company? So these are the realities on ground. These are things that are physical and are practical, and I can support it with evidence. I have investigated most of these companies. I am the one who came to London, to Washington with a complaint against Halliburton. I am the one who came to Washington to complain against Panalpina. I couldn't go to Beijing to complain about CCTT, whatever you call them.
CT.
Whatever you want to call them. These are companies that are doing transactions, billions and billions, and taking even the business of the Western world. And simply in each and every of such transactions, you see there is something that has taken place between those who are in charge of our own affairs and the companies. So the Chinese will not get in if we say that we are not ready to do business with them. There is a saying in Africa, they say that the wall has to break for a lizard to come in. If the wall is smart like this one, there is no way for a lizard to go in. The problem is that we are looking for those people who will come and help us to steal from our own people. And that the Western world tried as much as possible to make it difficult for their own companies, for their own people to do just that. They have realized the damage it has done to us. They did it in the 70s. They did it probably in the 80s. But a change took place from that period, 90s and up to this decade. And it is clear. But the newcomers, the people who are extremely rich in the world today, those where the money is today, do not seem to be getting it. If we want to help Africa, if we want to address this problem of corruption, I think we should start looking at that direction. The challenges are simply of that of management. by our own people in charge of our own affairs, first and foremost. Two, those who are willing to come alone and do those shoddy things for them to take part and then take benefits out of it. These are the real issues that I think for now we need to look at. And the West can still help. I don't know what you can do about China. I don't know how much you can do about India. Because India is not the government, it's actually the companies. Whether it is pharmaceutical companies, or it is a company that is producing spare parts, or they come, or the, their own who are into agriculture and so on, they are the ones who are really playing the huge law of compromising the customs duties and processes. They are the ones who are daily taking over and then putting aside the local industries. They are the ones who are not paying taxes. They are not. They are the ones who are doing most of those dirty things that is happening today in Africa. I don't know how much influence that can be brought to bear on them for them to also start going the direction of the OECDs, of the World Banks, of the United States, and the rest of the Western world that took measures that somehow reduced this problem. This is the problem. But for businessmen who are doing business in Africa, continue to respect the laws. Avoid those people who will want to come in with you. You will never regret it. You may suffer at the initial stage. You probably will think that the Chinese are getting advantage, but it is going to be very temporary because that behavior will not continue for such a long time. You will ultimately be the ones who are going to benefit. Nigeria today is turning again. We had between 2007 and 2008, when the government in charge of Nigeria, the one that is headed by the Sikh president, almost abandoned the West and he moved to the East. He almost took the entire gas business in Nigeria to the Russians. He almost took entirely all the new concessions that were coming out from the oil industry, and also the old ones that have come to more or less like an end to their own, and almost giving it to China. In December, they were to sign about $18 billion worth of transaction with the Chinese. And this is at the cost to the West, because simply the West is not doing what they wanted them to do. Luckily for us, it has been stopped with his sickness, and that possibly we would see some transparency in the process. This is what is happening. The reality is the same thing what is happening in Sudan. It's the same thing what is happening in Angola, I believe. It's probably the same thing happening in almost all where you have leaders who are ready to steal from their own people. It may not happen, for example, in Angola, in Botswana. It may not happen, for example, in Rwanda. It's not likely going to happen in Liberia today. Why? Simply because those who are in charge of those little states have been able to say, no, we are not ready. We are not going to steal from our people. This is the challenge that the world, all of us, will have to concentrate on.
Let me thank you. I'm going to take very quickly the three questions that are on the table and then turn to Ray and any final comments. Harry, you had your...
It follows up beautifully from Nuhu's last point, which is the role of sort of non-traditional investors or non-traditional donors. The discussion about who is to blame in some sense is, in my view, sort of somewhat old school. And it's not about governments less and less, in my view. It's more about multilateral organizations who are feeding the beast. And the fact that the Chinese and the Indians are not under the DAC umbrella, that the multilateral development banks, the individual bilateral donors, the private NGOs all have stovepipes, special issue funds. Although they give lip service, having worked in the World Bank for 15 years, about collectively harmonizing their aid flows, their resource flows to keep the countries in the driver's seat, the fact of the matter is that that fosters, frankly, the lack of governance. That fosters incentives for corruption. And when you throw the Chinese into the mix, it gets even more complicated. And I just wondered whether, you know, you could, particularly Raymond, could touch on that. But I think Nuhu already has begun to to touch on this point.
Good point. Shola, you had your...
No, I just didn't want the question that you, Princeton, raised, and that is the issue of institutional corruption in a place like Nigeria. Nuhu describes Nigeria as the laboratory for corruption, and everything you can think of in terms of corrupt behaviors is present in Nigeria. It was not too long ago that Human Rights Watch did a report on Rivers State in Nigeria. In fact, I don't think it was even the whole of the Rivers State. It was a local government area in the state. So the question of leadership is critical.
Yeah.
I can't submit that Nuhu was successful to the extent that he was successful because Obasanjo created an environment where that success was attainable. And so my issue is, what are the, Nuhu says things are changing now, and he gave a few examples just now. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the terrain that's opening up now with the acting president in place, mm-hmm. and how do we really address this issue of institutional corruption, because corruption is eating into the fabric of the Nigerian society so deeply that it's at every level. Mm-hmm. You want to renew the papers for your vehicle. Somebody gives you a file outside of the office, and they take it to the relevant officer. If that officer opens that file and he doesn't see a currency note in the file, you don't get to renew your vehicle papers. So it runs the gamut of the society. How do we begin to deal with institutional corruption?
You had a quick question.
Yes, sir. Jim Sesnicki from SEEP, and you can answer this after the break because I know we're over time. But you, to sum up what you painted a picture of, is that Africa has the money to solve its own development challenges, but that money is going out of the country. The West has stepped in and is building roads and schools and setting up microfinance banks through our official development assistance programs. But if you look at ODA as a tool to advance American foreign policy objectives, we're not achieving those results, since in the end all of the things are, all the concessions and things are going to China, as you're paying. So
yeah.
My question is, and you can answer it now or after the thing, is that if you were advising the Obama administration on the efficacy of current development assistance to Africa, would you say continue as is, or would you suspend official development assistance because it's not helping advance American objectives?
Okay, I know we're running over, but this is such an important discussion. If those who have to leave, please, but I want each of them to have a final comment and address some of these questions. Ray, I'll start with you, if I may.
I'll try to be brief. Henry's question, how do you do business in Africa? Don't bribe. There are two alternatives to bribery. One is to spend the time and the effort to move the conversation beyond that request. I've seen that done successfully. And the other alternative is to involve groups that are not asking for the bribe to assist you in avoiding the request for that. Money transferred, asset recovery, money transferred back to Africa. I think the asset recovery movement, which I'm all in favor of, has its greatest potential in curtailing the ongoing outflow of money rather than getting the money back. Yes, we've had some success stories in Nigeria getting some billions back. But for the most part, I think the STAR initiative and other initiatives to recover stolen assets has its greatest impact on forestalling the ongoing outflow when leaders see that this does not work. I was in Congo, Kinshasa, not long ago, and was told by somebody who thought that they had some reasonable information that Kabila is keeping his money in Africa. He is not taking it to Europe or Dubai or Singapore or Malaysia or Hong Kong, but keeping his money in Africa, in Uganda, in Zimbabwe, in South Africa, and so forth. If that's the case, that's encouraging. At least it's at least it's closer home than it was before. The role of the West in facilitating your Travis, is that right? Yeah. Some of you may be aware of the disconnect between the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and the receipt of illicit money, talking about the facilitating role of the West. Yes, we passed the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in 1977 that made it illegal for Americans to bribe foreign government officials. We did not make it illegal to handle the proceeds of bribery. As a consequence, the United States continued in that business very aggressively for many years. Mm-hmm. What happened was American bankers would follow along behind the European business people, and when the Europeans bribed, the American bankers would call on them and ask for those deposits to come back to the United States. That process went on until the USA Patriot Act was passed in 2001 that made knowingly handling the proceeds of corruption a predicate offense under our anti-money laundering laws. Harry, your question international financial institutions, governance, and so forth. Let me give you an example of a concern that I have. There is a proposal by the Zedillo Commission at the present time that the World Bank executive directors will become the governing body of the World Bank will become finance ministers from the countries. And this has been put forward as an idea for improving governance within the bank. I'm very dubious of that because it politicizes, in my opinion, the bank even more than it is now.
Yeah.
You will have finance ministers who are protecting their balance of payments and their current account deficit by keeping the doors open for money that flows around the world. I am very, very questionable about that, and I've discussed it with a member of that commission who defended it, but that concerns me a great deal. How do you fight institutionalized corruption? For many years, the development community was focused on building grassroots support for the fight against corruption. I don't think that works. Mm. I think fighting corruption is a top-down exercise, as Nuhu has approached this issue. I don't think I had this discussion with a Nigerian 10 days ago in Africa. Who was saying, oh, no, forget about the Ibori's and the other governors and so forth. It's the civil servants that you need to focus on. I don't think you can get anywhere trying to curtail corruption among the civil servants until you fight this from the top down. Fighting corruption is a top-down exercise. I don't think we can be successful in the fight against corruption until we address the system that facilitates the movement of corrupt proceeds. Yeah. That has to be an integral part of the problem. Nuhu and I were testifying on Capitol Hill not long ago, and a congressman was giving you a hard time about the fact that, it's all of your government officials that are requesting these bribes. I didn't have a chance to tell him that I've known lots of business people, Americans and Europeans, who offered the bribe before they were asked for it. Again, this is a two-way street that we're talking about here. We've got to work on our part of the act.
Thank you.
Quick, yes. So, well, to go direct, what can the U.S. do, basically? You have done a lot already, but what could be done probably immediate is to see what can be done about those leaders who are really, really corrupt in Africa. We have not seen a direct attempt to bring leaders who are corrupt to justice. We have heard about rights, human rights, and we have heard so. But when it comes to issue of corruption, nothing much has been done. I think direction we should start looking at it from that direction. What is it that we could do? We've seen, for example, an attempt by civil societies to bring few corrupt leaders in Africa to justice in France. And it suffered a huge setback because the courts almost resisted it. That would have been a major, major signal that there is no hiding place. Just like what, for example, the world is doing with terrorists, or the world is doing for human rights abusers. The corruption issue is as bad as that. And maybe some measures could be taken. If I have a way to talk to Barack Obama, I would tell him, can you come up with some ideas what you could do about that? Bring few leaders to justice on corruption, and you see the impact it will make almost immediately. Two, support internal effort to address it. Most of the things that happen in terms of fighting corruption at the international level are the risks of sounding even boisterous or even talking. It happened from us. We did it. We had the chance in 2003 to start this war in Nigeria. We understood probably how to, because maybe partly because of my background, a lawyer, a prosecutor, a policeman, Interpol. Now, the world never succeeded in getting back stolen money to any country before us. Whether it was Philippines, when Marcos took so much money, they never got anything back. Whether it was Mobutu or even Baby Doc from Haiti, but Nigeria got close to about $2 billion back. It's world record, it never happened before, and I can assure you, simply because of our own initiatives, we did it. When we got out, I took these basic steps. I met with, for example, the law enforcement in Washington. I said, look, guys, this is something that is happening, and it is also a criminal activity in your own country. Can you take an action? Can you do something about it? And almost instantly, we put out all those protocols, all this. I related with them, law enforcement to law enforcement. And it make almost immediate impact. There is not too much stolen money in America. America blocked its own doors long time ago. Not much came in. But even the few ones that came in, the DOJ was ready to act. I told you about when I came in, and I related with them, and they took cases, including their own companies who are doing business in Nigeria. And it almost sent a clear signal that, look, time has come for you to stop it. But it was an initiative that came from us. I paid Metropolitan Police for the work that they did for us. I paid their own travels, whether to South Africa, to wherever, and that's what makes the difference. I reached out to the authorities in Switzerland, and that was how we started changing. I mean, we started seeing the change that got us over $600 million from the Abacha administration. These are some of the things that I'm trying to say. Initiatives and efforts must come internally. And that internal effort will only come if there is a political will and a political leadership that will support it. The world could help us to marginalize the very corrupt leaders and make it impossible for them to feel free to continue to do what they like. And I think the leadership as it is constituted today in the world may be in a position to do that, just that. It's a huge ambition, it's a big one, but it is something that I think we could do. You have done most of the right things already, to be honest. I do not want to say that everything that is doable, I mean, you have done it. You have come with the laws. You have made it impossible for your own companies to do bad things. You have encouraged others to continue to do it. But the resistance that comes from internal political control in Africa made it impossible for us to see the benefits of those things. What can you do about it is the next challenge that can be confronted. And Barack Obama, the leadership of the West, will do something by simply saying that you cannot steal from your country again and get away with it. You can, just like you have done it with terrorism, just like you are doing it with human rights abusers, and say that next time any person, whether you are putting it in Africa or putting it in the Middle East or putting it in China, you will be able to go after you, and we are not going to do business with you. You will see how it will start changing. It has changed already, the whole issue about human rights abuse. It has improved greatly. Today, Bashir of Sudan is thinking twice in whatever he is doing when it comes to rights abuse. We need to do the same thing with those who are stealing in Africa. I think that is really the next challenge. It's a big one, but I think you, all of us, should find a way of encouraging it and going that direction.
Thank you. Rafael, last word?
I basically agree with what Mr. Nuhu has said, and I would like just to reinforce the need for cooperation in equal terms. I think it's important that the organizations here which are fighting corruption and governments tap into that internal effort of those on the ground who are trying to make sure they have clean governments. Basically, that's my call. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank all our panel members. I think it's been an extraordinary discussion. These are three outstanding individuals. And I think we've learned a great deal today. And I thank you all for being. Please join us.